You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Vibe Check by James Pogue. Raskin resisted the idea that Democrats had become the party of the status quo. To the extent that we are going to derive a grand political philosophy, a new public philosophy, he said, it will be one that emerges from the very specific programmatic answers we come up with to deal with real-world crises, including climate change, including economic inequality, and including the kind of social polarization which is being promoted by the right wing. It's consistent with the tradition of American pragmatism, he said, arguing for a liberalism that could bring a revolution by increments. And pragmatism gets a bad name because people think pragmatism means just adjusting to political reality. That's not what it means. He referred back to John Dewey and William James, who had proffered pragmatism as America's natural political philosophy. It's the use of social experimentation to address widely felt social problems, he said. That's where the Tennessee Valley Authority comes from. That's where the National Park Service comes from. A staffer gave us notice that we had to vacate the suite. I did want to ask you, she said to Raskin, there's an influencer next door doing special coverage. They said they have 5 million followers. They'd love to talk to you. Can we take 3 more minutes? Raskin asked her. In Democratic circles, talk about politics often stays within such a narrow band of issues and horse race chatter that officials at the DNC often seemed intrigued to talk big picture. Raskin and I talked about how Biden would be remembered and about the coming election, which he seemed confident Harris would win. He had written a letter to Biden 2 weeks before he dropped out, and it eventually ended up being published in the New York Times. I said that he would retire to the overwhelming love and appreciation of the country, he told me. And it would usher in an extraordinary cathartic outpouring of progressive energy in the country. I believe those things, and I think it has begun to come true. He looked out toward the floor. It's like a dam breaking in terms of progressive youthful energy for the future. That night, I went to a party hosted by Dropsite News, started recently by the left-wing reporter Ryan Grimm. I ended up vaping outside with a big donor to both the site and to the Democratic Party, a dapper and erudite man who'd been a construction worker before he made a bunch of money in finance, who was now looking for ways to push the party toward a more populist and anti-establishmentarian worldview. We talked about a passage from Norman Mailer's dispatch from the 1964 Republican National Convention held at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Mailer had written it as a picture of a moment when a wild new energy of conservatives in the West and the Sun Belt formed behind the candidacy of Barry Goldwater and caught the old establishment of the East, as Mailer called it, with its heartland stretching from Maine to Nassau, New York to south of France, off guard. This establishment had waited too long to find a moderately liberal candidate who bore its pedigree. It took half a century and the emergence of Trump to finally complete the rebellion Goldwater had begun. Mailer wrote of hearing a band of bagpipers marching constantly through the streets that week. There was a vast, if all private, appeal in listening to the pipes shrill out the herald of a new crusade, he said. Something jagged, Viking, hunters loose in the land again. And this had an appeal which burrowed deep. There was excitement at the thought of Goldwater getting the nomination. Against the Piper's tribal skirl, the left's answer had long been the promise of a utopian future built out of a collective struggle. Their welling energies were summoned by songs like Solidarity Forever, We Shall Overcome, and Which Side Are You On?, the miners' protest song written by a 12-year-old miner's daughter named Florence Reese. A hint of this old energy came on the first day of the convention from the United Automobile Workers president Sean Fain. He played on the fact that J.D. Vance's family came from the coal fields in eastern Kentucky and accused Vance of abandoning his roots to align with billionaires like Elon Musk. "Which side are you on?" he asked. But big-name Democrats and the consultant class these days often seem so professional, so competent, so well-trained that this kind of energy no longer fits into their calculations about how to win narrow elections. After the election, I saw clips of a moving speech given by Cecil Roberts, Jr., the West Virginia-born president of the United Mine Workers of America. He spoke to the blood that flows through our body as a generational memory of a multiracial and often violent struggle that now lingered as little more than an historical trivia curiosity to the technocratic-minded liberals who'd promised a just transition for laborers in fading industries like coal mining. He cast a pox on the house of everyone in power. "When you hear some rich person," he said, "some CEO, some chairman of the board, talk about the patriotism of their company or the patriotism of their board, understand something. Forgive me for what I'm about to say, but that's pure bullshit. That's what that is." Roberts knew full well that, at least in private, most senior Democrats saw him and his members as people who cling, in the infamous phrase Obama had used, to a lost world. But he argued that our economy is still, as much as ever, built on manufacturing and resource extraction. From lumber logged in Canada to industrial goods made in Chinese factories that are, in turn, powered by coal-fired energy. "Democrats have needed a wake-up call now for some time," he said, "and if there's anything good that can come out of this, I hope that they listen. At one time, everybody listened to me." "Union members voted for the vice president," he said, "based on what we've seen from the polls, but working people didn't do that." He thought the age of Democrats being able to present themselves as the party of the working class was likely over. "I'm a Democrat," he said. "I'm going to die one, because I've been one forever. But here's the problem. What about the next generation and the next generation?" Later, a collection of luminaries and media figures from the beleaguered Sanders wing of the party gathered at an Irish bar where hosts of the podcast Chapo Trap House and writers for places like Jacobin and the London Review of Books were getting drunk and talking with resigned cynicism about the proceedings. Not so long ago, this crowd had looked like it might have a chance to become what the young, bookish, and online right has become for Trump, the intellectual vanguard of an insurgent new power in our politics. Policy aside, the Sanders movement had always represented something more than a push for a bigger welfare state. At times, it had looked like it was building toward the kind of regime change dreamed of by conservative theorists like Curtis Yarvin and Patrick Deneen, one we may soon see. Conservatives today talk excitedly about a process of elite replacement that will see influential officials and power centers like New York finance and mainstream media lose place to newcomers from Silicon Valley or previously marginal conservative think tanks. Carried far enough, it's a process that approximates a revolution. During the election, Many liberals had trouble understanding this kind of world historical dreaming, which animated people even at the edges of a campaign that bore the mandate of heaven, as the pseudonymous commentator Peachy Keenan said on Fox News. Keenan was only partly kidding. This kind of talk was always a bit tongue-in-cheek, hard for people who weren't already in on the joke to get. Trump-backing tech figures talked dryly of a preference cascade that would see millions of people suddenly turn away from liberal cultural mores, media, even potential sexual partners. Others reveled in what it would all mean. Men were going to be ripped again. Blonde women with large breasts would mark our standard of beauty. Muscle cars would be cool. People talked about outfits they were planning to wear to parties on deportation day, when America would finally begin sending immigrants back en masse. People were going to be getting rich, making fantastic new drones in sleek new American factories. In wars, America would dominate. Everything was possible. Trump's success now, Jonathan Kieperman, the publisher of the growing right-wing house Passage Press, wrote in the days after the election, the electoral sweep, the taste for revenge that animates him and his newfound allies, the titans of Silicon Valley, all of it had come from a mythic journey that had seen them taste defeat and then back to the heights, a landscape of possibility before them. Kieperman himself was set to assume platinum membership in the new counter-elite of crypto entrepreneurs, disaffected veterans, and conservative intellectuals that would rise in a new Trump age. American dynamism has been tamped down for decades, he wrote. The doorway out is now opened, and we need only to walk through it. The problem for Democrats wasn't just that they had no golden dawn to promise. It was that, cut off in a separate media sphere, they had no way of even understanding the appeal of this whole cacophonous movement. Hatred for institutions can hardly be overstated, the Times Trump reporter Sean McCreesh wrote in the days after the election, describing a campaign that had often seemed like a madcap second line, picking up new partiers as the parade rolled on. It seems like they're having a lot of fun, McCreesh said cautiously, when I'd first met him at a Trump event that summer. At the Irish bar, I introduced myself to David Sirota, who had been a senior Sanders advisor and who probably would have had a White House role if the Bernie carnival had managed to roll on and win. But I ended up talking mostly that evening with a young and soft-spoken operative at the convention who'd run for Congress on a populist platform, trying to craft a Democratic message that would harness anti-establishment energy by appealing both to social justice-minded activist Democrats and disaffected types who turned Trump curious in recent years. He now had a sensitive job and was yet again wary of being named. But the next day, he agreed to talk anonymously. He kept trying to move us to a spot where we couldn't be overheard as celebrities and big-name officials filed by, and I made a joke about how I'd never expected to have to think so much about security culture as radical leftist activists describe counter-surveillance precautions at a joyous gathering of liberal Democrats. Well, he said, that's how it is. He told me that in polling for the general election, he'd been doing better than any of the Democrats running against him, though there hadn't been a path for him to actually win the primary. There are many districts across the country where the Democrats' best chance of winning is to run on a populist platform with a bipartisan credibility, he said, which is anti-corporate, skeptical of militarism, pro-civil liberties, pro-choice. But he said Democratic leaders and the fact that upper-middle-class voters now form the party's loyal base had made this approach very difficult to pursue. He didn't seem bitter. He was just pointing out a matter-of-fact problem that had arisen. as Democrats became a party ever more shaped by the views of well-off liberals and professional political consultants who knew a lot about how to win marginal elections but had trouble listening, as the United Mine Workers president Roberts had put it, to a sort of people that many of them just don't interact with much anymore. They were very concerned about winning this purple seat, and very understandably, very rightly so, the one-time congressional candidate said. But I don't think they were in a position to understand that someone with the issue profile I was running on was probably someone who would have been in a very strong position to win in the general, because they have such a compressed vision of what the left-right spectrum is. As we were talking, a small commotion broke out on the floor behind us. We turned to see Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy entering with a couple of staff members. Murphy was profiled at length by Eric Lutz in this magazine last winter. I had a more recent piece in the New York Times after Murphy contacted me about my own Vanity Fair story on the quasi-revolutionary ferment of the new right. Murphy has rolled out the closest thing to a big-picture vision of a break with neoliberalism to tackle the massive concentration of corporate power that he believes has created a system-wide crisis of Americans' confidence in said system. I introduced Murphy to my other interlocutor, and we spoke about the somewhat overwhelming response we'd seen that week to the issues we'd been raising. People are desperate to find a way into that conversation, Murphy said. It's not accessible enough yet. He just conducted polling he thought pointed a way toward a new organizing vision. The number one crossover testing message is the breakup of corporate monopoly power. It's number one. But Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn and one of the biggest donors in the Democratic Party, had just publicly suggested that Harris get rid of FTC chair Lina Khan, who had won support for her anti-monopoly efforts from the Jacobin left and from right-wingers like Gates. This sort of overt scale thumbing from a deep-pocketed benefactor is perhaps more common, or at least more commonly heard of, among the right. I ask Murphy if the convention had given him any hope for his brand of politics. Not right now, he said. He gestured toward the stage. This is Vibes. Murphy is sympathetic to fears about rising authoritarian overreach, but he saw a problem with the party focusing its message on the dangers of Trump. I think we make a mistake when we defend democracy on existing terms, he said. I think we have to give more credit to people. They have good reasons why they are in a conversation about the efficacy of democracy, and they're not interested in another 50 years of elites protecting democracy. A VIP in a wheelchair was coming through, and a security guard shooed us away. I love you, Senator, the guard said, but you gotta make way. On the floor, I met with Keisha Lance Bottoms, the former Atlanta mayor, who at the time was a Harris Walz advisor and a vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. For Bottoms, a younger black woman who'd been a big city mayor at perhaps the most febrile moment for urban governance in recent memory, the big picture questions were secondary to a basic impetus to get into office and deliver practical governance. She evinced a hint of frustration at the way that Democrats had come to talk like all Republicans were potential enemies. What's so unfortunate is that in this political climate, so many people are being forced to retreat into their corners and not publicly talk about the things that they work well on. She danced around a frustration that burst forth after the election was over. When I was mayor of Atlanta, she said, one of my biggest allies and supporters was Speaker Ralston from Blue Ridge, Georgia. For me, there was a lesson of not making assumptions about where people stand on certain issues because of where they're from or what their political affiliation may be. That the party had lost interest in the persuasion business as Jon Favreau, the former Obama speechwriter and co-host of Pod Save America, described it, got wide airing in the weeks after Harris lost. He looked scathingly at Democrats, who were now pointing to Biden's age and inflation and suggesting that in a different year, Harris might have won. The problem was bigger. Most Americans weren't convinced that they'd be better off under Democratic rule, he said. That's it. I think, if anything, we've learned over the last 3.5 years that moderation in just about all things is key, Bottoms told me at the convention. I think we do ourselves a disservice if we aren't willing to compromise and at least take into consideration other people's perspective, what their background and what their history may be. On the last night, I waited for hours after the Secret Service shut down access to the floor before Harris spoke. There was nowhere for anyone who wasn't a major VIP or a delegate from one of the states with prime floor-level real estate to sit, and no way to get a bottle of water or take a bathroom break. Everyone was shoving and grumpy, and I had occasionally to fight to avoid getting shoved into the little ring where an absolutely indefatigable Chris Cuomo had been doing stand-ups for hours, apparently without any break. "This is pre-show," I heard him tell a complaining guest. "You don't even have to go on. I'll cut you off right now." When the moment came, I was between the California and Illinois delegations. To my left was a man in a red keffiyeh named Alex Gallegos, who served on a school board in nearby Will County and had come as an uncommitted delegate. Gallegos shouted out the suggestion, punctuating Harris's nomination speech, that America provided the weapons to wage genocide in Gaza. If the broadcast audio picked it up, his shout might well have ended up being the most nationally visible expression of the one big rift in the unity Democrats tried so hard to convey that week. The uncommitted contingent, a few dozen out of thousands of delegates, may be most analogous to what was left of an insurgent and anti-establishment role played by Sanders supporters in the intra-party warfare of 2016 and 2020. I asked Gallegos how he'd ended up a delegate. They wanted more diversity in the delegation, he said. Everybody was black from Cook County. I'm a brown guy from Will County, so I got in. I struggled. They asked me. I struggled. But the diversity he brought wasn't exactly the kind many of his fellows wanted to see. "It's been terrible," he told me. "We have to show unity and everything. I'm one vote. I'm one guy. It doesn't matter. I don't matter." He gestured around at all the cameras and famous people near us. "I'm not doing it for this. Do you think I'm risking hatred and vitriol from everybody here for publicity?" He looked exhausted. "It has not been a friendly place." I said it must at least have been exciting to attend a convention with the eyes of the world watching in his area. "That just means I get to drive home tonight," he said, "but I thought I would be able to make more of an impact." Over to my right, the collection of mostly older delegates, seated, were surprisingly subdued. A black man in a well-fitted tan suit acted as a bit of a foreman, and at one point, when the group had begun a spontaneous chant of "Kamala, Kamala," he stood up and motioned for them to stop. The words seemed to have come down from somewhere on high. "USA, USA," he led them. Nobody seemed too excited about the patriotic posturing or cautious policy proposals Harris mentioned in her speech. The people around me wanted to cheer for Kamala. I hung around for a long time after the balloons dropped and people began to file out. I suppose I was looking for signs of the kind of overwhelming emotion and momentousness that I'd seen over the years after watching Obama and Trump in big moments. It didn't seem like Harris's fault, so much as the fault of a hyper-cautious Democratic Party culture that had trouble just letting a candidate rip. The moment reminded me of Mitt Romney's final event before the 2012 election. There had been a kind of rote excitement that night, engineered by professionals with very good skin and multiple graduate degrees, but it didn't linger. Before I headed out, a little demonstration took shape in front of the stage to an audience of no one but reporters. A bunch of young men who looked like they were on break from Duke and Boston College had assembled on some risers, chanting for a row of TV cameras and giving the impression of a hot crowd, fired up to go to do the work, as Democrats so often phrase it. An older guy stood by, organizing the show. "Don't be weird," he called out as I watched, and they all took it up. A refrain of don't be weird," echoed as I walked off the floor. I watched the election returns in Los Angeles at a small party hosted by Peter Thiel, who had stayed out of this race. By the time I got there, it was obvious Trump had won, and everyone spent most of the evening staring at their phones, already angling for jobs, and watching as the crypto markets started to rip. Kieperman was there, and I smoked several cigarettes with him as we stood a bit away from the party, looking out over the lights on one of those nights when you can see clear across the L.A. basin. "I still can't even process how much has happened," he said. Just 2 years earlier, he'd been an anonymous lecturer in the English department at UC Irvine. Now he was something like a celebrity, friends to those who were about to become some of the most powerful people on Earth. Smoking a rolled cigarette next to an elegantly situated pool and a table piled with delicate West Coast oysters. Now it's more than I could have ever imagined. It's all part of what comes when your side takes power. One of the very few Democrats who appeared to be having a good time in the weeks after the election was Congresswoman Marie Glusenkamp Perez, who'd just been reelected in a district in southwest Washington state. It includes suburbs of Portland, Oregon, but I knew the area from spending time with friends who worked small farms or as handymen on the rural north side of the Columbia River Gorge. Last May, roll call described Glusenkamp Perez as the most vulnerable Democratic incumbent in the House, and she ran for the second time against a former Green Beret named Joe Kent, who had been one of the very early adopters of the anti-establishment and aggressively conservative sort of populism that is now the basic MAGA style. It was hard to see how MGP, as she's sometimes known, would win this race, but she won by 16,123 votes out of 415,904. She was neither a mainstream liberal nor a progressive in the mode of AOC. She had gone to the exclusive and liberal Reed College, but like many Reed kids and people who've come up in the Pacific Northwest, she had a woodsy streak and a kind of natural skepticism of both big government and big business. I told her that I'd followed her career in part because I knew some anarchist types in her district. "Who do you know?" she asked, thinking she might well know them too. Kent, her opponent, was very openly committed to the radical plans driving the Trump 2.0 project. I asked if this had put her in the trap Democrats had often described to me. "From the sense of my district, I did not run for the seat to defend the system of power," she said. "I ran for the seat to defend the interest of my community and our values. And one of those values is absolutely democracy." But how are people supposed to judge the value or the efficacy of these ideas if not through their lived experience as normal Americans? People that can afford gas and medicine and groceries and child care don't typically vote for fascist candidates. She was contemptuous of the influential liberal voices that had spent much of the election season pointing to jobs figures and GDP growth, to argue that Americans were failing to appreciate a healthy economy. Economic metrics no longer seemed to be capturing the sense of creeping insecurity and lack of control over their own destiny that many Americans now feel. "I think there's just been a mistake," she said. I've seen people here in D.C. try to gaslight Americans and be like, you're just dumb, the economy's fine. And that doesn't work. People are really feeling the impact of lack of a secure border, putting groceries on credit cards. Talking this starkly about immigration was one of the things Democrats were often afraid to do. Some, no doubt, out of a principled pro-immigration stance. But in the weeks after the election, online debate on the center-left had turned into a long and baroque spiral of argument about the groups, a catch-all term for the plethora of activist organizations and issue-based pressure organizations that are, at least to their detractors, the reason why Democrats are now so nervous about breaking even slightly with the consensus of the party. Moderate centrists argued that these groups function to force Democrats into proving their purity by taking positions that were broadly unpopular. The progressive left countered by saying that Harris Walz had talked tough about the border and embraced people like Liz Cheney, but had lost by running a campaign that amounted to Trump light and would have had a better chance if it had embraced Bernie-style class populism. Gluzenkamp Perez suggested that both sides were talking from a bubble. I think everything has to be through the lens of local experience and culture, she said. I think this sort of capture of party priorities, where it's like if you're on the left side of the aisle, you have to have the same 10 priorities. If you're on the right side of the aisle, you have to have the same priorities. So that the consultant and industrial complex can sell the same effing TV ad in Ohio as Washington State does not make sense. She had won not so much by taking one side in the eternal battle between the parties, centrist and progressives, but by being of a very specific place. She spoke about the federal debt in language not too dissimilar to how many small government Republicans do. Anybody that's run a small business or a family budget is made queasy by the national deficit, she said, bringing up another issue Democrats often shy from lately. The payments on the interest are real, she said. Interest payments on our federal debt cost American taxpayers more than our military budget, and they're coming at the expense of my community. One of my counties just went down to a 4-day school week. She was aware that Kent would say Democrats were becoming the party of the national security state and the elite establishment writ large. I mean, I am not here to fundraise for Raytheon, she said, a joking disclaimer. I believe in domestic manufacturing. I believe in munitions manufacturing and union jobs and family wage jobs. She'd had a mini scandal last spring when she came out in opposition to a proposed regulation that could force manufacturers of table saws to install expensive sensors to help prevent finger injuries. It had led to brutal mockery from leftists, who, at least online lately, can sometimes take even a hint of skepticism of state power as a betrayal of values. But she had opposed this for the same reason that she'd become a champion of the right to repair movement, calling for manufacturers of complex goods to make documentation, parts, and tools available to consumers so those goods don't have to be tossed out or taken for expensive maintenance by the manufacturer. It was a major issue for farmers buying machinery and would be a small step to give people agency in a way that directly impacts the lives of millions. Her mother's family had all been loggers, and she'd witnessed the rapid decline of the public lands logging industry in the Pacific Northwest, a fight over conservation of the northern spotted owl that turned into a proxy for a culture war, and that in many ways saw everyone but a small group of large timber companies operating on vast private holdings lose out. She said that a spotted owl had just been found poisoned in Mount Tabor Park in the heart of Portland. The autopsy showed it died from rodenticide, Do you think anybody at a chemical company lost their jobs over that? She asked. Because all of my uncles lost their jobs, and so it is always the people with the least amount of power who foot the bill for bad ideas. As we finished talking, she circled back unbidden to the challenges of running against someone like Kent or Trump with the promise of smashing up the system. Do you know the term obstacle fixation? I learned this when I got my motorcycle endorsement, she said. Democrats were so fixated on one particular problem that they drive straight into it. You do not save democracy by running around yelling about saving democracy. You do it by demonstrating that democracy and democratic values deliver better quality of life for normal people. Not mandating safety equipment on table saws, but getting shop class in junior high. She saw this as the kind of base-level thinking that could lead to a democratic path toward national revitalization. That way we're not buying shit from IKEA that will collapse the first time we move it, she said. We can have a relationship with our mills and our timberlands. And then she let the thought linger. There was a lot of quiet activity and whispering going around in L.A. in the weeks after the election. In Hancock Park, not far from where Harris lived with her husband, Doug Emhoff, I met a friend of theirs who said something I'd heard often from Democratic donors and loyalists in those weeks, that everyone was over it, hardly even upset at seeing Trump win. It was a chance to see things blow up and see where the pieces landed. At a bar in Larchmont, I got a tip that I should talk to a man in his early 30s named David Adler, who'd recently left a job working for the activist and former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, and who now runs an organization called Progressive International, an attempt to build out a global left-wing alliance as an answer to the world-spanning right-wing coalition that had grown out of the efforts of people like Nigel Farage and Steve Bannon, about whom I've written for this magazine. I spoke to him while he was in town for Thanksgiving. He had a bleak take on the election, but a very expansive vision for where center-left parties around the world need to go. The Democratic Party of the United States has convinced itself that the only feasible strategy to maintain both its electoral base and its governability bona fides is to become the institutional defenders, he said. Defending the big D democracy has been a major point through which they've attempted to stave off this populist revolt. Adler was looking south. The most successful center-left project of the 21st century of our hemisphere and of our continent is Morena in Mexico, he said. In winning huge victories, first for Andrés Manuel López Obrador and then for the new president, Claudia Sheinbaum, that political party had managed to do what Democrats could not, he said. Put a woman to follow an aging man, providing a program to deal with social, economic, racial, and gender issues, and win a massive majority in the presidential elections. It guaranteed them the capacity to legislate with a deep social consensus. To do this, Morena had started from a point of speaking to deep disillusionment with the whole system. They did it by continuing to rage against the machine, Adler said. They did it by running, in other words, as anti-system incumbents. He thought the bedeviling division in the Democratic Party between Bernie-style class populist and social justice-minded liberals obscured a bigger problem. We're not talking about including people in a system that everyone hates, he said. We're talking about changing that system. I'm not speaking here as a leftist. Even famously moderate Democrats are now facing the fact that the 2024 election was, more than anything, a protest vote against a whole political order. A Latino voter in Vegas told me that his two favorite political leaders were Governor Ron DeSantis and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Favreau had written in his Atlantic piece, because they were both outsiders who were willing to take on the establishment. An older Milwaukee voter said that he had voted for Barack Obama and then Donald Trump because they both felt like change. A young black man in Atlanta said that because of crime and inflation, he regretted his vote for Joe Biden and that at least Trump is an honest liar. Trust in the political system is at record lows, Adler said. Turnout is at record lows. People hate politics. And what they hate more than politics is they hate politicians. Like it or not, he said, draining the swamp was one of the most salient ideas of recent times. That's a popular message. It's something that people can and should promote. This would mean more than adopting the kind of economic populism that people on the American left often argued would have given Harris a better shot. It would mean coming up with a program that disrupted the interests and bases of power that had, in the view of a very large portion of the American public, corrupted the system for its own ends. The Democratic Party seems structurally incapable of putting forward a program that would cut against the core interest of what it perceives to be a constituency these days, he said, which are these corporate allies. They're very proud to have Disney on their side. They're very proud to have Wall Street on their side. They're very proud to have the military-industrial complex on their side. It's not just about economic populism, he said. It's about changing the whole way in which the game is fought. Behind the scenes, a lot of Democrats are already trying to draw up a vision like this, but it will take leaders. In early December, I went to the Beverly Hilton, where the Democratic Governors Association had gathered for a two-day meeting that served as the kickoff to the 2028 presidential primary, live and in person, one advisor told Politico. I didn't have credentials, but I snuck into the closing party, which had a classic rock theme and a live cover band. I had a beer next to a consultant who'd once been the chief of staff to Jim Carville, and was talking to a clutch of lobbyists holding plastic souvenir DGA 2024 cups. All the governors and most of their staffs had cleared out. Almost everyone left was a lobbyist or a consultant. Almost everyone was white. Almost everyone looked rich. I was hoping to meet Colorado Governor Jared Polis. Colorado had the smallest shift toward Trump of any state in the presidential elections, according to findings by Axios. Polis had recently helped launch an initiative called Governors Safeguarding Democracy, which Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said would be pushing back against increasing threats of autocracy and fortifying the institutions of democracy that our country and our states depend on. But Polis had made a few clear signs about his willingness to work with the Trump coalition, most obviously by tweeting that he was excited by Trump's pick of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. What I'm most optimistic about is taking on Big Pharma and the corporate ag oligopoly to improve our health, he wrote. He had said a wrong thing and drew a predictable backlash. But Polis later told Ezra Klein that he'd been sad to see RFK leave our coalition, which includes crunchy earth mamas, Big Pharma skeptics, and believers in climate change, who had helped him win his statewide races comfortably. He had actually skipped the DGA, but he agreed to talk to me later, and he had clearly thought a bit about what it meant to govern as an anti-system incumbent. If not in the left-wing way Adler described, then at least in a way that could win in the Denver suburbs. When we spoke, he was less confrontational than the resistance-style messaging coming from Pritzker. We want to work with a new administration that we have, he said. Just like there's risk, there's also opportunities. He brought up several times that his parents had been anti-war protesters and that he'd grown up in the milieu of the counterculture, But he didn't see this as the domain of a single party. We don't want to be the man. We want to take on the man. So I think that's very much the ethos of the Democratic Party that I'm a part of, and we need to show that more. He intimated that the categories of left and right had started to outlive their usefulness, but he rejected the idea that appealing to a broad coalition meant tacking toward the kind of moderate centrism that the Harris campaign had tried to display, and that many pundits were now telling Democrats to adopt more fully. When you talk about freedom, people on the left or right and the middle like more freedom. There's some stodgy people in the middle who don't. I get really irritated when people say it means you need to be milquetoast moderate. That's not at all what we're talking about. Breaking up the oligopoly of chemical companies and agricultural megacorporations that dominate our food chain was of a piece with this, a project that would give Americans more freedom to write their own destiny by small-scale farming if they wanted, or to have more control over what goes into their bodies. But that would take looking both at corporate power and the way that our regulatory system now has the perverse effect of aiding these big companies at the expense of family farms. I'll go further and name names, he said. We've got Monsanto and the way they keep small farmers beholden to their practices, and it's about processed foods. It's about all those things. It's true that corporations have co-opted government in many areas, and it's the wrong discussion to have government be bigger or smaller when they're co-opted away from the public good towards the self-interest of certain corporations for their own benefit. So that's a more important discussion to have. I'm all for government being smaller, but even more important for a government working for people. A politician who drinks raw milk, as he has, talks about the evils of big agriculture and is in favor of deregulation in certain areas would probably be assumed to be MAGA. This was bizarre to him. I don't know if you saw yesterday, but I took a saw to a bunch of regs, which was awesome. He hadn't been thinking about Team Trump when he did it. We've been working on this for many months. As we finished up, he returned without any prompting to the question I'd been needling since the DNC. He used a word I had tried to avoid. For me, counterculture is culture, he said. I'm a gamer. I'm on Reddit. I had to learn what the mainstream media was because I've never heard of it. The trouble is, there's no such thing as a counterculture anymore. A pretty large portion of the richest and most powerful people in America today were shaped by the values of the 20th century countercultural rebellion against establishment politics and bourgeois sexual and social mores. Republicans today often talk about conservatism as today's true counterculture. But now they have their long-desired chance to become the establishment. It's a chance that Democrats took in 1829 when Andrew Jackson opened the White House to a mob of revelers and instituted the spoils system of federal patronage. Republicans under Lincoln revolutionized government again in the 1860s, making space for previously unthinkable growth in the size of our government and the reach of federal power. Democrats took a turn again in 1932 when FDR began the reimagining of the role of government that became the New Deal. If we're fortunate, the cycle may yet go on. It's very important to always have a cynical and skeptical view of the establishment and those in power, Polis said as we wrapped up. And that includes when you're in power. That's something never to forget. splash pad. For more than 170 years, the craftsmen of the Baglietto shipyards in La Spezia, Italy, have built some of the world's most sought-after boats, from a yawl for a pope to a yacht beloved by Peter Sellers. A new book dives deep into the archives. In the photos, the prototype of the 18-meter Carrascafale built for Prince Rainier of Monaco. In the 1930s, Baglietto became the official shipyard for the Kingdom of Italy, designing motorboats like the ME-91 for King Vittorio Emmanuel III in 1938. Known for its speed, the seagull became the symbol for Baglietto's boats. A sketch of the dining area on Caroli by architect Lorenzo Castello. The open launch panda of Queen Elena, 1939. The MAS 431 built for the Royal Italian Navy, 1930. La Spina, designed by Vincenzo Vittorio Baglietto in 1929 for Admiral Genese Marchese Franco Spinola, the name derived from the spigot or spina of a wine barrel. A sketch of La Spina. Peter Sellers and Britt Eklund in front of their 18-meter Amalfis. The contract between U.S. Baglietto importer Josh von Neumann and Baglietto to build Nasheed Chateau, a 26-meter all-aluminum yacht designed by Alcide Sculati. Sketches of the owner's cabin and guest cabin on Caroli. The Baglietto Adler, designed by Alberto Mercati. These photos were reprinted with permission from Baglietto, The Art of Yachting Since 1854 by Antonio Macaluso, Rizzoli, 2025. Was the publisher and the date. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Both Parts A and B stream via the World Wide Web. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.